Sagar and Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
This week, we're excited to bring you Hudson Institute Senior Fellow Rebecca Heinrichs. Rebecca specializes in nuclear deterrence and missile defense. What we wanted to talk with her about is a recent debate she had at the Oxford Union in favor of the proposition that the Trump foreign policy is preferable to the Obama foreign policy.
Rebecca's speech hit some key areas that we focus on here at The Realignment. So we dig into the substance of the Trump administration's foreign policy, engage with some of its critiques, and settle on a core, clear-eyed assessment that the administration's foreign policy brings to the major threats the United States faces in the world today. We also discuss the benefit that President Trump's irreverence has given a much-needed shock to the system of international politics.
Throughout the episode, you also hear parts of her speech from the Oxford Union. With that, let's dive in.
Rebecca Heinrichs, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Of course. Well, we're so happy that you're our inaugural guest in our brand new studio here, which looks fantastic. We have some really interesting stuff that we want to get into today.
Yeah. So, Rebecca, we wanted to have you on because last May, you went to the Oxford Union in the United Kingdom, and you debated the following resolution. This House prefers Trump's foreign policy to Obama's. You were debating with Admiral Dennis Blair, who was the former director of National Intelligence, and you also debated against Amy Pope of the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama and former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson. So we just thought it'd be great to unpack this actual debate and discussion you had.
Great.
Well, so let's take a listen first to the three premises that you put forward for if you believe that the Trump foreign policy is preferable to the Obama foreign policy.
If you begin with the premises that it is good for sovereign nations to join together to form alliances based on common goals and to defend against shared enemies with a clear-eyed assessment of who those enemies are and to rank them in order of priority, and that treaties and agreements are not goals in and of themselves, they are tools, means to an end to further U.S. security and the security of our alliances. And if you agree that America is a better steward of the mantle of global superpower than, say, the People's Republic of China, then allow yourself to be persuaded that the Trump foreign policy is, in fact, preferable to the Obama foreign policy.
So in that clip, you talked a little bit about the three separate things. First, that it's a good for sovereign nations to come together, form alliances against these shared enemies. Treaties are not goals in and of themselves, but tools of accomplishing specific ends. And America is a better steward of the mantle of the global superpower than China. I think we should start with the first one. If it's good for sovereign nations to come together and form alliances, why is it better for sovereign nations to form alliances than to kind of supersede power to a multinational group like the United Nations or the European Union, something like that?
Great. So so central to the Trump administration's foreign policy has been this return to the defense of the nation. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of our national debate, we get really caught up in this idea of nationalism. But if you just kind of put that aside and just think of, you know, is the United States a separate nation? What does it mean? What is the federal government's responsibility to its own people? And if you start from that building block, which it might seem like an obvious point to some viewers and listeners, but it's actually pretty controversial, especially in the national security realm. But if you start from there, it'll help you come up with priorities in national security policy, and it will also help you make better decisions. And I think the Trump foreign policy has been sort of centered on that idea. And we can talk about specific areas,
sure,
but that is something very different than the way, for instance, the Obama administration viewed the nation and globalism or internationalism.
So let's talk about that, because to put my Obama administration hat on, they would say we prioritize alliances. That's why we did things such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's why we worked in concert with our NATO allies. They'd probably argue that that's not what President Trump has really done. So how did this rhetoric take place during the Obama administration?
Sure. So I'm actually a big defender of alliances, but alliances only so much as they benefit the United States. So for instance, take the Paris Climate Agreement. That's a really easy one to kind of see the difference. So rather than sacrificing American national security interests or American economic interests, you sort of put that aside for the sake of the greater good, the planet. And it has this global governance feel and texture to it, rather than what is good for the United States. And you can look at other areas in which the Obama foreign policy kind of sacrificed American interests for the sake of, you know, the global good.
And I think this gets to something which is pretty visceral to people, which is they say, everything that the United States is a part of, an alliance, you know, a trade agreement or what have you, is something that should really be to the major benefit vis-a-vis another nation to the United States. And why is it that was so contrary to the Obama foreign policy? Like, what was it about their thinking that led them to the belief of kind of like a one worldism, like a one people?
You know, I think that there's several different things that play into that. Mm. One of them is, and this is admittedly just a sense that I've had, but if you listen to a lot of, go back to the point when President Obama was asked if he believed in American exceptionalism, and he gave that answer, I believe in American exceptionalism, like Germans believe in German exceptionalism.
Greeks.
Which, in other words, it's not exceptional at all.
Right.
And that we're just, you know, one among many nations. And so it's a lack of clarity and certainty about what America is, mm-hmm. and the rightness and the goodness of our people and what we stand for. And if you don't have that clarity, and if you don't have pride in our heritage and our, not to say that you gloss over the flaws, but that you understand that where America has flawed is not because the founding is flawed or a meaning is flawed. It's where we haven't lived up to the founding and the meaning of America. And so if you start from that premise, you get all kinds of crossways with being able to defend our nation as a good, and to put the priority and security of Americans first.
So let's talk about the tensions between American exceptionalism and the desire that we should further our own interests, right? Because you're talking about the role the U.S. has played since World War II, being the steward of the global order, there is a tension between acknowledging that our engagements abroad should benefit our country, but there's also there really is this greater good, right? If you're Switzerland, you're not having this tension doesn't exist if you're Switzerland or Sweden, but it exists with us. So how do you balance responsibility to the global order with the need to advance our own interests as well, too?
Great. And I think, first of all, acknowledging, and this is where a lot of people who are very supportive of Trumpism in their own mind of what that is, and then American nationalism, I think, kind of fall off the horse here on the other side, which is to say, you know, America, we are both a nation of ideas and a physical people with an actual heritage, with actual borders and actual landmass. And so we are both of those things. And I think where we can go wrong is to say that we're only going to care about the ideas, and also think that the rest of the world shares those ideas.
Yeah.
I mean, being American, the people who settled here and developed the country and fought a civil war and continued to make improvements to become, to live up to the ideas expressed in our Declaration of Independence, were actual people. Mm-hmm. So you have those ideas, but you actually have to believe them. So, for instance, you know, this idea that if we just liberate Iraq,
right,
then all Iraqis will just want to become Democrats, small d, and pursue freedom, and that turns out to not be true. So you actually have to buy into the idea. That's part of the consent of the governed, buy into that idea. But in order for us to, you know, be good stewards of this and to be sort of the city on a hill, we have to take care of and cultivate that within our own country first.
And that's a very important point that you make. And one of the things I liked most about your debate was that America's a better steward of the mantle than a global superpower than China. Because what you're saying there is not that America needs to take care of itself at home before it can do anything abroad. It's we have to both, you know, internally have our things together, but also project power on a global scale to prevent China from taking over that global order. And why do you think that is so in tension with the previous foreign policy, which emphasized multilateral institutions.
Yeah, great. And yeah. And this actually, that question kind of goes to the heart also with a debate that's going on the right, sort of the Rand Paul idea, which is, yes, we want to return to taking care of ourselves, which means pull up the drawbridge.
Right.
And actually, I don't think that that's actually the instinct of President Trump, mm-hmm. actually.
Really?
And I don't think that it's right. I don't. And I'll say that the reason for that is he's very willing to use force, for instance, when Assad used chemical weapons
right.
and we came in and he was happy to use force and then pull back and mm-hmm. but very reluctant to send troops in. And then he was very willing to invoke fire and fury to threaten
right.
that against Kim Jong-un when Kim Jong-un was popping off ICBMs. And so it's a focus on deterrence. You want to build up our military. President Trump's not talking about shrinking our military or this peace dividend. He likes to brag about refurbishing our military and investing in our military so that we have the world's best military. And that gets back to what is deterrence. So you want to have the strongest military. You want to take care of your own country economically so that you can wield force and our economy in a way that deters conflict, protects the United States, defends the alliances that we believe serve our own interests so that we can move and act in the world on our own terms. Mm-hmm. And that gets back to the first point, which is a central point, which is you want to strengthen American sovereignty.
So let's go to the revisiting the China example. The premise here is that the Obama administration was furthering China's ability to take over the mantle of the global order. The other sort of Obama advocacy I'll do here is that they would argue that by taking and pursuing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would bring together non-Chinese Asian rivals against China, they were seeking to actually oppose that. They would say that the pivot to Asia was all about that. So what were they doing that contrasted with Trump then?
Yeah. So, and I will say too, I'm happy to admit that I think that President Trump doesn't even further his own agenda, I think, sometimes well. So I don't even have any interest in defending. You can find all kinds of things where I think the president even gets trips over himself sometimes. But to your question, which I think is a good one, is that if you go back, think about, you know, I think President Trump was wrong to praise Xi Jinping recently on their anniversary. On the anniversary. That was but I thought it was interesting though, because though it elicited a lot of condemnation from all corners of the political spectrum, a quick Google search shows that President Obama and John Kerry did the same thing
right.
every single year. But then if you kind of peel the onion a little bit more, you see that President Obama was very effusive to Xi Jinping. Mm-hmm. And still, even as late as 2014, I believe it was, 2015, where we were really awake, especially with inside the Pentagon, to the dangers of the rise of China and China's military, you still saw President Obama expressing this desire to work with China, that China's rise was peaceful, and that we still have these mutual benefits that we can pursue together. Where I see President Trump actually saying, no, Xi Jinping is not pursuing a peaceful rise, and you can see where they actually understand it as zero sum, and this is actually a Stalinist communist regime that's trying to undermine the United States.
The tension, in my view, was that the Obama administration made the gamble that by working and trying to draw China into multilateral institutions, that they could constrain their rise. Now, I would argue, and I think you would too, that it was actually the opposite, is that they broke the rules and then claimed legitimacy by being a part of those multilateral institutions, so that the president's emphasis on American sovereignty and unilateral action in some cases is actually what enables somebody to constrain China.
That's exactly right. It's this liberal, progressive, Wilsonian notion mm-hmm. that if you just bring people in, even if they are initially adversarial, that perhaps it's just because of misunderstandings. Or, you know, it's a misguided notion of something, that if you partner with people and if you have international bodies and agreements, that we will clarify what mm-hmm. those misunderstandings are. When actually, if you go back to Trump's sort of gut and John Bolton, which I actually think he had a much more fleshed out understanding from a policy perspective, because this is what he's devoted his life mm-hmm. to, where President Trump's been a businessman, is that no, actually regimes are different. and they're motivated by different things. In the case of China, it's Stalinism, it's communism. And so even if you bring them into these multilateral agreements and trade agreements, you never get rid of that underlying problem. It's the same thing with Iran. We can talk about Iran. Mm-hmm. President Obama gambled that if we had this deal with them, that they would moderate over time, when in fact they didn't. They're as radical as they were before the deal. Mm-hmm.
So let's go to the, so you then, when you're going through the debate, you talked about two specific critiques that the critics of Trump's foreign policy make are specifically on the one line. He has withdrawn from international treaties like the INF, which have to do with missiles in Europe. And they argue that these treaties have underpinned the liberal international order. So can you sort of flesh that point out a bit?
Yeah, this is like one of my favorite things, because for years I've been saying, you know, it's related to the last point, which is that, you know, this idea that you have an awkward uncle in your family, and if everyone just pretends that he's not awkward, that it'll be good for everybody rather than actually confronting the issue and getting to the root of disagreement. And we've had all these treaties that have actually served to undermine the United States. It hobbled us, like the INF treaty, the Russian.
What does that stand for?
Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, but it actually is not just nuclear. It actually dealt with conventional weapons of a particular range, ground-based cruise missiles, ground launch missiles. But the reason we had, it was a Cold War treaty, but it was between the United States and the Soviet Union, but then Russia continued to violate that particular treaty. And meanwhile, all these other countries that were never party to the treaty developed these kinds of weapons, in particular China. Mm-hmm. But the United States had our arms tied behind our backs because we abide by treaties. And we would like to develop those weapons for a variety of reasons, but if we're constrained by it, we can't. So President Trump rightly withdrew from the treaty. And a lot of people were upset simply for the fact that we withdrew from a treaty. They thought, well, no, we're going to have an arms race with China or with Russia, when both China and Russia were developing and deploying those kinds of weapon systems. So that's a perfect example of something where President Trump, very willing to buck the sort of conventional wisdom which is you got to stay within treaties and you'd have to constantly work to get everybody on board. At some point you run out of patience and you say, forget it. If you're not going to abide by this treaty, we're out, because I care about U.S. interests and not the treaty.
This is something we were getting to earlier that you talked about, which is that for some reason there has been almost, I would say, an overcorrection from the post-World War II era to say that treaties are a good in and of themselves. Not what they actually, absolutely. Treaties after post-World War II to prevent the rise of global conflict was absolutely important. Dialogue and all those things. But that doesn't mean that it needed to, I guess, supersede all national interests and we should stay within them just because we're already in them.
Well, especially if the other countries aren't going to abide by them, and especially when global dynamics change.
Right.
So what made sense 30 years ago, 40 years ago, might not make sense now if you have different actors that have different national objectives now, different kinds of weapon systems, they're doing different things. We have different nuclear powers than we had before. So, you know, we need to adapt as the world adapts. And if the treaty no longer makes sense for the United States, we shouldn't uphold the treaty as the goal. The treaty is always just a tool or a means to an end.
What do good treaties look like in this space? Right, so if you're president now, 2024, how would you reimagine treaties? Because the argument for treaties is that these are rules. There's predictability. You can make plans based off of them. Like, that's the longer-term defense of them.
Well, you have to make agreements. Like, for instance, in the case of Kim Jong-un, North Korea, one of the things that I've continued to argue is, you know, this is why you always have Secretary Pompeo or John Bolton saying, we need to see Kim Jong-un make the strategic decision to get rid of his nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. What that means is he changes his national goals. He actually, like Gaddafi did, you know, John Bolton got in trouble for saying the Libya model, but he's right when he talks about the disarmament piece of that, which is that you make the no-kidding decision to get rid of your weapons, and then you freely allow inspectors in.
How did things turn out for Gaddafi?
Which is the North Korean argument, right?
So North Korean argument, to which I respond. The problem with that argument, though, is you had it was President Bush that was able to, his team negotiated the disarmament.
After the Iraq War.
It was in part because they saw that the United States was willing to invade a country over WMDs. So they thought, oh my goodness, it's not worth it for us to have that. Mm-hmm. But then you had a follow-on administration where President Obama was persuaded by Samantha Power primarily, and others within the White House, that they should help in the overthrowing of Gaddafi. Although it wasn't primarily the United States, we assisted in doing that. Now, I think that was a mistake, but I think that it's a bit of a stretch to tie that directly to what the previous administration did in disarming Gaddafi. So I think that the lesson there to learn is, you know, one, we need to be very careful with helping regime change. I think we should have cared more about the optics of that in terms of disarmament. But, you know, the lesson there ultimately, I think, for a guy like, you know, other dictators in the world is, if you look at Gaddafi and see what happens, don't be a dictator.
Yeah. What's so difficult here is that, and this is where I think critics will sort of object to this notion of Obama made all these mistakes, Trump is making these corrections, and foreign policy is complicated,
sure.
Right? So there's everything second order. So we've sort of insinuated that the war in Iraq may have had some ill founding in terms of the idea that you could democratize a country, but also had this good spillover effect, a.k.a. Gaddafi decided that I need to be much more cautious with my, you know, nuclear weapons program. So how does a president or an administration, especially on the intellectual level, which is what we're talking about here, we're avoiding personalities as much as possible, how do you balance those things?
I'm happy to even talk about what some of the things I think that President Obama did well, some of his instincts I think that were good, but I do think that he fundamentally viewed the U.S.'s role in the world very differently than how President Trump views the world. And so, you know, that was the premise of the question in the Oxford speech was, you know, I was there to defend Trump's foreign policy versus Obama's foreign policy. It wasn't even saying that it couldn't be better or that I would do things better. But it is important. You know, I think one of President Obama's crowning achievements of which all Americans should be proud of is whenever he authorized the kill of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, for instance.
That's controversial back then.
And in fact, it still is that he authorized that. And I think that was a great demonstration of American leadership and decisiveness in that particular instance. But again, you know, President Obama's one of his biggest problems, I think, was his uncertainty about what America even is. And then what do you do with that as you carry out foreign policy? And it led to a lot of indecisiveness, I think, that threw a lot of confusion into the world.
Yeah, well, this is the other interesting thing, which is what you noted in your speech, was that the opponents of President Trump's foreign policy, they say that his coarseness and actual just personal style has undermined NATO. But Bob Gates, under the Obama administration, gave a withering speech to NATO in 2011, telling them that if you do not step up your military spending, the American people will lose patience with Europe. I mean, so is it just a matter of personal style? Because it almost seems like it's a bipartisan complaint that Europe is not doing its fair share when it comes to this defense agreement.
Right. I think a lot of it, I mean, I laugh because the same people that I have heard privately say NATO needs to contribute more. It's ridiculous that we're spending all of this money in South Korea and the South Koreans don't even cooperate well with us, or their Moon Jae-in is always undermining U.S. policy with North Korea. The national security analysts and people who are involved in this, Republicans, Democrats, people say these things privately. You know, President Trump, and then you made the great point about Gates making that speech about how NATO needs to contribute more. Even Secretary Mattis, when he was Secretary of Defense, gave this powerful speech to a NATO audience in which he said, paraphrasing, that you need to care more about your children's future than Americans care about your children's future. Wow, that is what a thing to say to people. But he can say it in a diplomatic, sort of poetic kind of way that doesn't draw so much attention and passionate disgust as when President Trump says, you're freeloading. We're going to pull out because I think it comes down to people believe President Trump when he says that kind of thing, because I think he means it. He's been saying this kind of stuff for years more than they believed the threats and the condemnations from previous presidents who were speaking off a teleprompter or, you know, who kind of said the very polished, vetted remark about how you need to contribute more, but there really isn't going to be consequences if you don't.
Yeah, there's a real urgency whenever it comes to acting upon what Trump is saying, because, he does add that unpredictability factor, and that's what actually makes them change.
And he doesn't seem to feel the pressure of convention at all.
Right.
So if you go into his office, and I've heard this is true, if you go into his office and if you make the case, sir, you can't say that, and he says, why? And you say, because we're not supposed to say that. That is not going to persuade the president. It's not a good enough reason. We have to go back to, this is why I actually think one of the great advantages of President Trump's administration and his style and presidency is it's forcing a lot of us who work on these issues to go back and make your argument, reapproach these things, think things through, because, you know, he's asking a lot of good questions and he's saying some things out loud that I think are important.
Yeah. Well, to this point, I mean, this goes to one of the other main things that you highlighted in your speech is the clear-eyed assessment the president has of American foreign policy and really just what the foundation of that foreign policy is. Let's take a listen to that.
The Trump foreign policy is predicated on a long overdue, clear-eyed assessment and prioritization of the threats to Americans and our way of life. And it recognizes these diverse and complex threats from rogue actors, yes, but also from great powers.
So during that, you talked about, you know, the adversaries of the United States and the challenges the administration has handled better than the Obama administration. So based on that framework that you laid out here, let's do some of the specifics that we wanted to get to, like China. You said the Trump foreign policy recognizes China is an adversary of the United States. What makes that fundamentally different than President Obama?
Well, if you view what China is doing as an adversary, you're going to do things like reorient your entire military.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's a huge missile gap. The Chinese missile arsenal outnumbers the U.S. in that region by a lot. I hosted the current director of the DIA, director of DIA over at Hudson Institute not too long ago, and he said that China has tested more missiles in 2018 than the entire planet combined. So, and they're doing that because they're holding at risk U.S. critical bases in the region, the sea lanes, which are critical for the U.S. economy, and our allies in the region. And so now we're desperately trying to kind of get ahead of that and invest in systems that we need to and get them deployed. So unless you have a clear-eyed assessment that this is a threat and not just an economic partner who is trying to outsmart and get rich with the United States or against the United States, but actually truly understand them as an adversary in which we actually have to compete with and do something about, you're going to be vulnerable. And I think that if we had stayed on the path that the Obama administration was on, you know, the Chinese would achieve their goal, which is eventual global superiority.
Yeah.
So let's speak to the use of the word adversary, because in your speech, you actually use it quite a bit. And I think that's something that to people who sort of grew up post fall of the Soviet Union, they're not really used to. We're used to conceiving of sort of terrorist groups or non-state actors, but this discussion of great powers who have the ability to fight conventional conflicts with us, that could have trade wars with, that's new. So can you talk with us about how your thinking has changed or hasn't changed, especially over the past few years on that topic?
Well, I mean, I've always been a little bit different in the national security world than some of my peers, because I've never been confused about the point that Fukuyama was wrong. Mm-hmm. We're not all moving towards a bunch of peaceful democracies.
So Francis Fukuyama's end of history.
End of history.
End of the Cold War. We're all just advancing towards the glorious future of liberal democracy.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I just in my observance of people, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Now I have 5 kids and I can see how human beings work and are, and that doesn't make sense to me. And so we are always going to have the problem of different countries having different regimes and different national objectives. That is the nature of human beings, you know, post-fall. Mm-hmm. You know? So that is just something the way we are. And so there's going to be conflict. And sometimes there's going to be intermittent peace, and then that changes. And then, you know, so the challenge for us is that what are the biggest threats? And United States can't possibly now with the rise of China, with Russia is a very formidable military adversary. You know, we're going to have to start picking and choosing what are our priorities and how do we contend with them? Which adversaries are the alligators closest to the boat? Because we can't take them all on at once.
That's interesting, because something we talk a lot about on the podcast is how the conservative movement's changing, especially with foreign policy. And to your point of how you always were sort of suspicious of the Wilsonian history's moving forward narrative, during the Bush administration, the Republicans very much didn't adopted that mentality. So why was that? Like, why did that happen, and what changed?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard question, but I think part of it is you sort of have to go back to first principles again. You know, what is, you do, as Americans, this is kind of how we are, which is like something endearing, but also just vexing sometimes, is we think that other people think like us. We think that other people, you know, that it's just a series of miscommunications, that, you know, we're not actually different, that we all want freedom and prosperity if you just leave us alone. And that the problem is just the government. If you lift the government, you know, the dictatorship off the shoulders of people, you're just going to have a bunch of free North Koreans and a bunch of free Russians. And when right. in fact, you look at Russia, and Russians like Vladimir Putin. Yeah. You know, he's quite popular.
Hong Kong, the mainland Chinese.
Well, that's a perfect example. I mean, the Hong Kongers are a different kind of people than the Chinese. Mm. Why is that? And that has to do with the ideas that they've held on to, that they believe. There's nothing racially or ethnically about them that determines this. It has to do with what ideas they hold on to be true.
Right. A quick note, I wish you'd been here when we had Bhaskar Sunkara of Jacobin on, because we were talking about foreign policy, and he said the Chinese have the same DNA as us. They're human beings. Why would we expect them to act any differently? So it's just so funny how we're seeing how your foreign policy would be quite different if you assume everyone's the same.
That is exactly
this
right.
This isn't about genetics. It's about, no, the Chinese have a 3,000-year history that's different than our 400-year history.
That's exactly right. And so you have to have a combination of, you know, again, you have a history that gives you a shared sense of experience and brotherhood within your own country. And especially in the United States, that does super, you know, go beyond different divisions within our country, is that we should have a common bond. I think, you know, a reappreciation of that would do wonders. And I think that's what President Trump is trying to do with this sort of American nationalism that he has talked about.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, to bring it back to some of the specific issues on North Korea in particular, you could not see a more stark difference between this administration and the previous administration. I mean, the president started out in 2017 with fire and fury. The next year he was in Singapore shaking hands with Kim Jong-un. I mean, President Obama largely, I think I wouldn't say saber rattled, but had some stern words. But all the while, the nuclear program of the North Koreans was marching onward. What do you think that there was heavy criticism of the Trump administration for shifting so quickly between, you know, having tough words for Kim Jong-un to literally meeting him. What is the thread that unites that? And why do you think it's more beneficial than the previous administration?
I think President Trump, above all, is... He's immune to being shamed by convention.
Yes.
And so he's happy to threaten nuclear holocaust one minute if you're threatening the American people. And then if you want to meet, he's happy to do that too.
Yeah.
So he doesn't feel that kind of pressure. Now, that also means that fire and fury can be back on. And I don't think that's totally off the table. Now we've seen... Kim Jong-un has not made the strategic decision to get rid of his nuclear arsenal. Every single nuke and missile that was there in the beginning of the Trump administration is still there. And I think time is ticking. And although I can't imagine...
Ticking towards what?
The North Koreans have been able to continue their program even as they've stopped the ICBM testing.
Right.
You can still build out the number of missiles even if you stop testing. You need testing to increase the reliability, which is important. And it's not a small thing that they've stopped that, the ICBM testing moratorium with Trump. It's still not harmless that they've resumed shorter range, medium range, because we have troops and allies within range of those. So I think that they're now beginning to think that maybe because Bolton's gone or because President Trump is now, you know, he's got this impeachment stuff and he's getting ready to face re-election, that they can get away with more. I think if President Trump does get reelected, we might see a return to fire and fury. Yeah. And I don't think that, you know, you can't even imagine a previous president doing that, going from fire and fury to beautiful letters back to fire and fury. But I think that it is definitely within the realm of possible with Trump.
So the last area that when this comes to sort of the places on the ground we've seen this contrast, it's with the Iran deal and the entire discussion. Because there's a lot of tension, I think, between a lot of the people who are trying to reimagine the foreign policy on the right. Because on the one hand, no one wants to go back into the Middle East. No one wants another like major land war there. People don't want to intervene. That being said, there also is this, and the way that the President Obama framed the issue was, it's the Iran deal or it's war. So this is the sort of perfect issue where everyone sort of has something to lose here, especially from an intellectual level. So how are you sort of approaching that issue?
I mean, if you can put anything into it. It's either this deal or it's war. I mean, you could say the same thing with North Korea. Now you could say, and I think that's just a false choice. Now, in the case of Iran, the Iran deal never moderated the actual Iranian regime. Mm-hmm. So you can say
they got more emboldened.
Well, they got more emboldened. They continued their proxy wars. They continued funding all of their proxies and also continued their missile development. You can look at all of these different things. So that was a false choice, I think, that President Obama laid out. Now, what I think that the Trump administration towards Iran is doing, I just read a piece in National Review on this, is it's actually working, and by working I mean it's drying up funds for proxies because of the sanctions. Though I don't think that we should ever take military force off the table, and this goes back to the original point, you want to deter conflict. So we should always be willing to use force if the Iranians press it. But so far, if you look at what the Iranians have done, they've still stayed within a box that they think, just below that threshold in which they think, no kidding, the United States is going to have to retaliate with military force. You can see that this is what seems to be what the president is thinking when it talks about the UAS system, that the Global Hawk that the Iranians shot down, it was unmanned. So, no Americans were on it when there was a military plane nearby that did have military members on it that they didn't shoot down. And not to say that that was insignificant, but they're still trying to provoke to try to get the president to relieve sanctions without eliciting a military response. So we'll see how it goes, but
it hasn't worked so far.
It hasn't worked so far.
Yeah. When you were talking about Syria, you know, you said that President Trump, they used chemical weapons, he struck. What do you think a policymaker on the right should be considering when it comes to Iran and the rubric of conflict? So, for example, shooting down an unmanned drone. But when it comes to piracy, when it comes to attacks in Iraq, how should we think about those issues?
Yeah, I would have a hard time coming up with my own red lines at this point.
We should avoid the term red lines.
We should avoid the term red lines. But I do think, you know, part of what's important is if you are advising the president, and when you're sitting in these, making these hard decisions, they should know in their mind, what are the primary American national security interests of which we cannot abide them being threatened? And that needs to be very clear. Now, sometimes it's going to be hard. That doesn't mean very serious things that we care about are going to be threatened. But it does mean right now, when we are trying to regain the strategic advantage where China has taken it in some areas, militarily especially, or the Russians, when we're trying to invest in that, that means we have to make hard choices, which means we're going to take on risk that we otherwise would not want to, but we're being prudent, we're being wise about how we make decisions.
Final thing we wanted to talk with you about was about if you set aside feeling, you said, and if you think more, we can recognize that the current foreign policy is preferable to Obama's. I thought you articulated it really well, so I want to take a listen to that.
Yes, the president is irreverent, perhaps. If irreverence breaks up the groupthink and wakes us up from a slumber, I think we can more than manage. Put MAGA aside for just a moment. Thinking, rethinking, finding allies, bolstering allies, finding new political alignments, that is great again. The Trump foreign policy, perhaps bumpy and uncomfortable, has grabbed the reins and pulled us all back from a languid drift rooted in a dangerous cocktail of confusion and naivety. I suggest less feeling and more thinking. The previous administration failed to recognize and tackle the hard problems and uncomfortable truths that free nations must reckon with. We are doing that now. And it is because of that that the Trump foreign policy is preferable to Obama's. Vote for the motion.
And I mean, what you summarize there is that arguing for irreverence personality is actually necessary to confront today's challenges. That's something that is very contra the conventional wisdom here. And I want you to expand on that.
Well, when I that comment that I made is one of the things that got the most attention. But the point that I was trying to make is if you listen to the other side, the people that I was debating against, they were very fixated on how offensive President Trump's personality is, mm-hmm. and how it's offensive to our European allies. And the example that I pointed out of which why this doesn't make sense, if you look at the substance, a lot of people got mad at President Trump for being very for criticizing Chancellor Merkel,
right?
For being unkind to her or being indelicate or being rude, which to me I thought, but everything he's saying is true, and it's long overdue. And Angela Merkel has been emboldening the Russian Federation by pursuing energy policies that make Russia richer. So which one is worse? Which one's more offensive?
Right.
The actual policy that hurts the United States and NATO security, or the fact that President Trump is calling it out?
And it's fascinating because, I mean, she, you know, is arguing for, before a lot of the stuff in Syria, appeasement on Ukraine sanctions, you know, pushing forward on these Russian energy and gas deals. It seems to be the disconnect between the policy and then the presentation. Why is that? Why is it so offensive in Europe and to so much of the, I would say, foreign policy establishment here? Is because it's not that they agree with Chancellor Merkel. It's just that he's not doing things the way that they are supposed to be done.
Right, and it's, you know, it's. I mean, it's shocking because you have, again, you have the president of the United States being very clearly pro-America, mm-hmm. which means that all these other countries that in the past have sort of banked on the United States, sort of taking it on the chin a little bit for the sake of the greater good,
right.
that's no longer the case. And now you have to really grapple with that in a more serious way. Mm-hmm. And also it's just the rudeness of it. It just comes across again. It's just the presentation of it. I mean, he says things in a way that are shocking because you know that he means it. And so if you have NATO, for instance, just kind of going along, emboldening Russia, but also getting all of these security guarantees from the United States, you know, you get used to that and that's comfortable and it's good. And now he's saying, no, that the alliance depends on these sovereign nations caring about themselves and contributing to security.
So I think two questions that we'll wrap with, and they sort of lead from each other. So how sustainable is that irreverence? Because like him or dislike him, President Trump is a thoroughly unique individual. So it doesn't seem to be, so if the dynamic we have here is that you need someone who's willing to call these things out, that doesn't seem like we're going to have someone else who could do that in the future. And then the question that leads from that is, the next time there's a conservative president, how much are they going to sort of follow this playbook, both on the policy level and the personality level?
Right. So I think that President Trump is a shock to the system. I don't think that every single conservative Republican president needs to be a shock to the system.
That'd be very unconservative if you think about it.
you know, what? In other words, you know, people, we don't need, we definitely don't need, you saw this with Senator Rubio trying to be Trumpian in speech during the Republican debates, and that did not work out for him. Mm-hmm. So the goal should not be to mimic the president's style. I think that is a mistake. And so I think for Republicans who are doing that, they're learning the wrong lessons. I think the right lessons are go back to first principles. What is the purpose of the United States government? What are we supposed to do? And then how do we assess these threats, make smart decisions, and then have the guts to carry them out, mm-hmm. and not to allow yourself to be browbeaten by the European Union? So, I mean, those are the lessons to learn. So mm-hmm. any Republican president after Donald Trump is going to have to, if you go back to just talking points that we have used for the last 30 years.
What's your like top three outdated? You don't have to do three, but what's a talking point you think that?
Anytime you see us going in, you know, pro-democracy sort of, all this language, or the global international world order.
We should probably ban that term from op-eds.
Yeah.
Well, right. You still see, and I won't mention specifically, but you still see senior officials still using that in their speeches. you know, we need to start making sure that we're making clear arguments to the American people, because ultimately they're the ones that are in charge. You need to be persuading them. Why are we in South Korea?
Right.
Why is NATO important? Why is this deal, what does it no longer make sense? Make your arguments and stop making these sort of very vague, what do they even mean, kind of go along to get along statements.
Well, it struck me that some of the people that were most upset and critical of the president for congratulating Xi Jinping on the 70th anniversary were some of the people who were most vehemently against the trade war or about resetting the U.S. relationship with China. And so, to your point, it seems that we've sacrificed so much rhetoric to one higher ideal, but then when it comes to actual policy and execution, that hasn't borne out.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, we sort of have this notion of he shouldn't say that, we shouldn't do that, or we need that treaty, we need that. Why? And we've stopped. We don't even know how to. So many people don't even know how to answer those questions. And if think tank analysts and people who do commentary, you know, you can talk amongst yourselves and be, you know, grab, you know, clutch your pearls over the whole thing, or you can get back to and explain why is this wrong or why is this right, and go back and make your argument and try to persuade people. And I think that we're going to have a more prudent and robust foreign policy that makes a lot more sense if people do that.
Final question we have for you: is there any going back? Is there any going back to the previous consensus after the president has gone?
I don't see how we can do that if any Republican president ever wants to win an election again. You know, you actually see a lot of what the Democrat candidates are doing is they're running kind of hard left again, even in foreign policy. It's very Wilsonian, and they think that that's the answer. And I think that that's, you know, you see the reason that Tulsi Gabbard, that, you know, is so popular among some on the right and left is because she's making arguments about just challenging consensus. I think that her conclusions are very wrong in a lot of ways, and I disagree with her staunchly on some very serious policy conclusions, but she is willing to ask the hard questions and say, why are we doing this, or what makes sense for us? Mm-hmm. And so I think that those kind of people are the ones that are going to be successful.
So if we're never going back to the sort of, if we're never going back and we should move on from the sort of cliches about foreign policy that sort of animated us for 30 years, what advice would you have for conservative Republican policymakers and politicians who are sort of struggling to articulate and frame their sort of decisions in this area?
One of the things would be understand and appreciate what it is the American people are saying about foreign policy, because they're signaling some pretty clear things. Take Afghanistan, for instance. I think it makes a lot of sense, and you're going to earn a lot of credibility with your voters if you can admit that now it's time to go out of Afghanistan. Not to say that the decision would be easy, but to look at it clear-eyed and say, and you don't even have to say we lost that war. This was a war that was very popular among the American people. We went in there and we smoked the Taliban. We killed a lot of Al-Qaeda after 9/11. And we eventually got bin Laden in Pakistan. So, you know, we did all of that, killed a lot of terrorists. But if the United States now isn't willing to go in Afghanistan and get the rest of, you know, the leadership, Al-Qaeda leadership, we're just fighting a protracted war and sacrificing the lives of men and women.
And I think what you're getting at is getting out of Afghanistan is not an end to of itself. It's to rebalance the U.S. military against China and to rebalance our strategic initiatives and direction, because if you're bogged down in one place, in a sense, there is a zero-sum nature to military interest.
Well, and that's absolutely true, but then it also, people wonder, why are we there? You should be able to make an argument and persuade the American people of this. You know, this is something that is not only our interest, but it's worth the sacrifice, blood, and treasure. And if you've lost that argument, you shouldn't be there against the will of the people. You know, so I like this turn of phrase from Angelo Cotevia out at the Claremont Institute when he says, the United States needs to mind our business and mind it hard.
Yeah.
So, you know, you either go, you got to be choosy and prudent about when you engage, and then you go hard. You don't have these long sort of low level protracted wars in which the American people lose confidence that we even have an interest in being there.
So it seems what you're saying is a huge issue on the right is that the language that conservative politicians use to articulate foreign policy hasn't actually kept up with where the base is, base and the broader broader American people are.
The global dynamics change, the American people change, and you can see here we are 18 years later in Afghanistan. And I mean, I can argue that it was perfectly fine to go in there, but we should have gone hard and we should have actually gone into the mountains and wiped out all of these Al-Qaeda, and we didn't. We made some decisions about how to engage in the war because of civilians and other types of things that caused us not to actually carry out a war in which we could have gone in there hard and gotten mm-hmm. out. So regardless of that, I mean, I think at some point you have to say, I'm not for war everywhere. There's a problem.
Yeah.
And so you can say in Afghanistan, look at where we are now. And be honest about taking on some threats. A lot of politicians are afraid to say, let's get out of Afghanistan because there might be another attack. We still have plenty of Al-Qaeda running around the planet that want to kill Americans. And I think saying that and being upfront about that, because we can't possibly just be everywhere all the time to take out this threat, and that we actually need to recruit some allies. And this gets back to sovereign allies, mm-hmm. building partner capacity so they have the ability to defend themselves like the Saudis, so that we can actually delegate a little bit more and then focus on the primary threats to the United States and then try to deter the other attacks the best we can.
That's well said.
And one basic question that we should have asked you at the start, who won the debate? You know, because these Oxford Union debates are very prestigious. They're very interesting. Who, like, turn for purely from sport perspective, who won?
Well, so I think this is funny. So when we were walking into the Oxford Union, I had never been to Oxford, and when I didn't really know what to expect except from just watching some YouTube yeah. videos. Mm-hmm. But when I walked in, I said I felt like I was walking to my execution. we're walking.
You're
inside.
Wearing red, so it's sort of a, like, yeah. you're on
where,
brand
what,
for that.
What am I doing here? Yeah. And we had dinner before the debate, so I got to talk to some of the students, and the left in England makes the left here yeah. really look right. modest.
Well, this Jeremy Corbyn.
Well,
people.
You know, one of these wondered. No, I wouldn't. But one of we didn't get to that topic. But one of the individuals I spoke with, you know, he said one of the problems with you is, you know, the problem you're having right now in the United States. And I said, what's that? Thinking he would talk about, you know, something about Trump or something.
Yeah.
He said, federalism.
Ah, right.
You know,
right.
so
first
I mean,
principles.
yeah.
First
principles.
So,
well,
but I do think I don't remember the exact number. So after these Oxford debates, the students then walk through one of two doors. One door would be like to support
my side.
It feels
very British.
Oh, it's very,
yeah.
the
very
whole thing.
British.
Yeah. And then you vote for the other person and the other team, you walk through the other door. And we got whooped for sure. That
didn't
they,
see that coming.
And then, but yeah. I will say, but we did get, and again, I don't remember the exact numbers, but we got it was not a small number of people who voted for us. Mm-hmm. Which to me, you know, without knowing, I wish that they would have voted before. So, you know, you vote before
right,
and then you
and
vote
who,
after to
see
whose mind was changed. But I speculate that we did persuade some people that our argument was stronger because of the high number we got. Mm. But the other side did. Yeah.
Well, I think we'll persuade a few more minds here. So thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for coming.
Pleasure. Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed the episode. To view the full Oxford Union debate, please check out the Oxford Union's YouTube page, and you can find more of Rebecca's work at hudson.org. As always, please rate us 5 stars and make sure to subscribe. We'll see you next week.